Today, we are finally getting to a topic that is one of the most commonly asked questions that we get: how to parent after deconstruction. This episode is sort of a sequel to the Lost and Found series that we did in the first season, as well as The Other Side of the Mattress. In those episodes, Science Mike and I discussed our loss of faith and the rebuilding. And then on The Other Side of the Mattress, we brought in our wives, Lisa and Jenny, and talked about how all of that affected our marriages and our lives. Today, we are talking about how our families have handled the big questions since then. We don't claim to be experts on any of this, so please don't listen to this show. As such, we are not experts. We haven't even finished parenting our own kids, but we're simply fellow travelers sharing our experiences with you. So welcome to the Liturgist Podcast. We're so glad you've joined us.
I think what makes this topic so requested is for a lot of us that have gone through changes in our faith, we value, and especially if you're a listener to this show, if you listen to this show, there's probably something in you that values something about where you've come from and the stories you've inherited and the faith practices that you've been given. But there's a lot of bathwater that is very dirty that should go. So, like, how do you pass that on to the next generation, to your children who you're responsible for helping form their thoughts and what stories do you hand them? Which traditions? And how can you do that in a context like for us? We aren't currently going to church, but when we even do visit churches, we're like super nervous about what are they going to teach? We just hand off our daughter to whoever happens to be teaching or volunteering in the back.
Yeah.
And let's hope that they don't give her a whole world of shame and darkness.
And it's interesting because a lot of parents, we've talked a lot about this on our last tour. It was the question we got a lot. And some parents will tell us, like, oh, I'm just going just for my children. And that even seems so backwards, right? Like, for some reason, they're thinking, well, what the main guy is teaching, they don't like, but they want their kids still to have this foundation in something that they don't believe. It seems so backwards. Like, somehow that's not going to mess up their kids because they're kids. And maybe it somehow doesn't matter as much. I mean, it's the same thinking that goes along with, well, women can teach children because women are second. It's this whole idea, like, it just doesn't matter as much with the children. And it's crucial. You're setting the tone for the rest of their lives of what they are building on or what they have to deconstruct. And so, yeah, we are so careful about where we take Amelie.
You can have shame can really sneak in so quickly and easily where there's just like this. I mean, I remember one lesson from when I was in children's church where this guy brought this popcorn. And he's like, hey, kids, you want some popcorn? And we're like, yeah, it smelled delicious. It was just microwave. And he's like, here you go. And then he poured paint all over it right as he was about to hand it to us.
Oh. We're like,
dang,
so
have I told this on this podcast? I don't remember.
That's so mean.
And then did some brownies. Like, oh, sorry about that. Here's some brownies. And we ate into the brownies and had cotton inside. And we're like, what the hell? He's well, not what we know. What the heck? And
what the gosh darn?
And he's like, you got sin in your hearts. So it's like this just real memorable lesson about, like, you have sin in you, and you are evil, and you just need to do this to not be. And I just don't want that.
I remember in youth group at my church, they told us if you took communion and you weren't ready or prepared, you could get sick or die.
Yes, yeah. I was told that too. I was so terrified.
I was terrified. I would be so devoutly praying every time it was time to have the Lord's Supper because I didn't want to get sick or die because I had unconfessed sin. So
because
I tried to
think
of everything I could have possibly done. And I come with these crazy, contractual prayers, like, God, please forgive me for all the sins I'm aware of and the sins I'm unaware of. I lay them all before you. Like, you know, I mean, just like really, really the penitent man will pass. The penitent man will pass. Like just this intense time of fear and shame associated with, you know, the most holy sacrament of the Christian tradition.
I got sick once afterwards and I thought that I just didn't find the sin that was in my heart. I just couldn't, I couldn't find it. God was hiding it from me.
I mean, to be fair, it's in the Bible. So if you're going to go to a place that they're going to teach the Bible.
True. Well, yeah, with a certain, with one lens.
Well, but, I know.
So that's kind of the point.
Yeah, exactly. Like
there's one thing to kind of acknowledge in this conversation is the perspective we're all in is parenting after a faith transition, but there's also a lot of people parenting during faith transitions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so for many people, the reason they go back to church with their kids, even though they're not sure if they buy all this or not, is basically insurance. What if I'm wrong? I don't want my kids to go to hell. Like maybe I'm okay if I go to hell. I don't want my kids to end up in hell. My kids have tough questions about the afterlife, about where we came from, about God that I can't answer, so maybe the church can. Also, frankly, in many cultures in America, if you're not part of a church, you are more socially isolated, and your kids have less opportunity for socialization. So there's all kinds of social and economic incentives associated with church participation, and people, especially in faith transition, they don't have some new way of viewing the world. They simply have a critique of the old way they viewed the world. But in the absence of a new system or a new vision, they fall back to something that seems safe or normative. Because especially like a faith transition tends to be a stressful experience. It tends to be something that creates grief or depression or stress. And so you might look back to the way you once believed in a very nostalgic way and then want to give your children that positive experience and maybe even spare them from what you're labeling as a more negative experience during faith transition. So I think it makes a lot of sense, really, that people end up taking their kids to church even when they're not sure they're on the same page, even when they've had really bad experiences. So I think what many people are wondering is like, how do I have better conversations with my children? How do I address some of these big issues? How do I give them some of the good things that came from my religious upbringing without also giving them the shame, the oppression, the stigmatization, and the fear that have come from that same tradition? Hey, Madison.
Hello.
When did you first know that things were different or things were changing around here and how I think about God or how Mom thinks about God?
Well, I never really actually knew until, even then I didn't really know, but when we moved churches, I wondered why something would happen like that.
How did you feel when we changed churches?
I felt really sad. Like, I remember we were on the couch and we hadn't gone to IBC in a couple of weeks. And I was wondering, like, when are we going to go again? And I asked you guys. And you guys said we weren't going to go anymore. And I was just really sad because I had grown up there pretty much my entire life.
Your entire life? You went to that church before you were born.
And I had to leave my friends behind, which was sad. But I got to see them in fifth grade.
Do you like church now?
Yeah. I'm actually kind of glad, but I feel like we left. It was really good that we left because now I've made new relationships with adults at Good Sam, friends my age, and our youth directors. I just have a really good friend group there.
How did you feel when you found out that I didn't believe in God for a while?
I was just surprised. I didn't judge you at all. Like, I was just kind of surprised. It didn't hurt, or I was just surprised.
So it was more concerning to you that we changed churches than anything that I believed.
Well, the thing was, I didn't know that you had been going through this stuff until you started writing your book. And so I was like sad, and I felt empathy and sadness for that time you went through and how you had to hide it from us and Mom for a while. I felt sad about it, but I wasn't gonna judge you because, I mean, if Dad doesn't believe in God, it should be okay.
So that actually ended up being encouraging then.
It helped me realize that I can believe what I want to believe.
How should parents talk to their kids about God?
Well, it kind of depends on the age. I remember when I was little, we never really talked about God that much. When I was really tiny, we just, like, you guys explain what God was, or that, like, he created the earth and stuff like that. You just taught, like, the basics of what you believe, and if you believe something differently, like, just teach them, like, kind of the groundwork of that. And as they get older, kind of build up that, and if all of a sudden you have, like, a big bang and you think something differently, well, then try to, like, do some new groundwork for that.
That's good advice. Thanks, kiddo.
You're welcome.
I know for me, I was really scared, and the way I was raised was if you were not within the religious context, that you're going to be a less moral person. So I think, yeah, so many parents have that fear. And in looking in, and knowing that we were going to talk about this, I was looking online a bit about some different studies, and there's a study, I mean, there's so many out there, but one specifically from Duke University says that kids that are raised in a secular upbringing, they display less susceptibility to racism, peer pressure. They're less vengeful. They're less nationalistic, less authoritarian. They're more tolerant. And the list of benefits for not being raised in a religious family is amazing. It's amazing.
Too bad they go to hell.
So I think taking that...
I was kidding. Maybe people don't understand that I was kidding.
I think they do. Okay. I think they know who you are.
I don't think that would surprise anyone at this point.
So taking away that fear of, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen to my kid if they don't have this, they're not moral. I thought it was surprising. Even one study was saying most of the people in prison have religious upbringings. And there's this idea, this moral licensing that's happening. When a person feels permitted, even unconsciously, to do something wrong because they see themselves as a morally correct person. So your religion is like, you can do whatever you want to do, but your religion, because you've said something, is saving you. And so kids are being raised in religious circles to not even be kind because they have this idea that it doesn't matter as much. And obviously not every single family, but as a generality, parents in religious circles are so concerned about their child's happiness and are not teaching them as much about caring for the other person, which is very interesting considering like what Jesus' life was about. There was a Harvard study on this, like asking all these children that grew up in religious families what the most important thing was, and they said their own happiness. And it was interesting, the more they focus on their own happiness, the less happy they are, the more the focus on someone else's happiness, the more moral they are. And I found that interesting with Amelie because when we were going through this whole crisis, I didn't really know what to say to her. And the only thing I kept being sure of was, and it sounds really simple, but Amelie, love yourself, love other people, be kind to others. And I've been really surprised at how Amelie has adapted to this whole shift with us. And I think it's been really smooth. I don't think she's been confused. I mean, the conversations I have with her have been kind of even profound for me. We'll ask her, like, what do you think of God? What do you think that all of this is? Because she'll ask us. I mean, just the other night, her and I stayed up. She wrestles a lot with, why are we here? Why did God make us? And what's our purpose? So she's... kind of like throw herself on the sofa, you know, in this anguish. What is all of this? And I mean, she's really, really asking it. And I'll just throw the question back at her. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in our children that we cover up when we just want to hand them all the answers. So for us, I've found it very even enlightening for myself, listening to what she has to say about it. I think it's important to listen to our kids.
Amelie.
Hello, Dada.
How are you doing?
Good.
So you've been on the podcast before. You know how this whole thing
yeah.
works. We're talking about parenting and how do people talk to their kids about things like God and love and
now
stuff like
that. Now that is a very good question.
Tell me your thoughts about God.
I think God is made of love, and I think God's I love him because he made us and he made a wonderful life and created us.
Where'd you learn that?
School.
You did? When you think of God, do you think it's a he? That God is literally like a boy?
No.
So why do you say he?
I just have to find a name, you know?
I know what you're saying. If you could tell parents how they should teach their kids, what are your thoughts about it?
I think they should teach their kids that love is better than hate.
What are some of your biggest questions?
Why we were made.
And what do you think about that? Do you have any answers?
No.
No answers?
No.
So if you could tell somebody, if somebody says, what do you believe, Amelie? What are your beliefs?
I would say Santa, God, and fairies.
Well, the secular thing, I think it's worth mentioning. That's an interesting study. I think you need, what does it mean to be in a secular environment? I think in post-Christian environments, that's a different thing than, you know, pre-Christian. It's a different thing than Babylonian culture. That's whatever, you know. So to say a secular, a lot of times in our society, that means post-Christian, which means that there's been the foundation of Christendom is inescapable in the West for most people. And if you've gone through the typical structure, so all the essential Ten Commandments, moral teachings that have come from a practiced Christendom, all the turn the other cheek and love your enemies and all of the things that have taken root through things like we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. All of that speaks of where we've come from as a society, which you can't divorce from Christianity. So secularism you can have a whole thing about just secularism. What is that in our society?
Well, I think what they're speaking to in this study is the nuns and duns.
Well, yeah, the thing, so I did a lot of research. I actually read that study. I did a bunch of those writing Finding God in the Waves. And the big thing you will look for in studies that contrast differences in religious and non-religious or church attending and not church attending people is, did they adjust for income and education?
Yeah.
Because secularization is an almost, in America and even in Europe, an incredibly affluent high education phenomenon. Mm. And what you typically find is the sample size is so low for low income or below poverty line secularists that they can't create an adjustment in the data. And they usually disclose that in their findings or their methodology. So there's a lot of interesting correlations, But I don't think the assumptions we can pull from that data are as clean as are often presented. To what degree are the attributes associated with secularism actually attributes of high income, high education individuals?
Yeah.
And can you pull that apart? Mm-hmm. And then in the same way, there are also some studies that show advantages to people who attend church in terms of generosity, personal satisfaction levels. But in both cases, pulling either direction, you are drawing a bell curve of a population distribution, which is never going to be true for any one individual in those distributions. And the curves overlap significantly. So one thing I would want to say is it's not like a panacea or a death sentence for your children to go to church or not go to church. And it's also highly dependent on the type of religious traditions. There are big differences reported between Catholicism, mainline Protestant, evangelical, in terms of how those curves play out as well. It's an infinite sea of data that's I don't know. I had a real hard time drawing meaningful conclusions from it. I actually got to the point of like data paralysis.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too, because as I was looking through these different studies, even on some different science sites, it would say the exact opposite. All of our stuff, new research has shown, and that I was actually going to say that after this, of the Duke study, because I was reading this other one right after that that said the exact opposite percentages. I just don't understand that. But I know you've done a lot of research in that of like what, you know, what prayer does to your brain. I believe prayer and meditation are good for us and have long-term effects. They're very beneficial. But I felt like all the arguments were just all over the place.
Well, the amount of variables are too great. Like, how can you possibly have that? I think pretty much all child-rearing studies, in my opinion,
Michael,
are BS. I mean, how can you possibly account? Forget about...
Here's the rare point of agreement between Michael and Jenny. Jenny's like, don't give me your studies.
I mean, I normally love studies, but in far as like, you're taking one factor of a childhood and just put it in a different lens of like spiral dynamics, you know, you could, which colors are secular? Mm-hmm. You're probably polling most of the people from like orange or green, but that has a whole bunch of other stuff attached to it other than just religious stuff. And yeah, you're right. What sort of religious background are you talking about? Are you talking about Pentecostal? Are you talking about? And that's still, even if you narrow all that down to precisely, what about the kind of schooling you had? What about the temperament that you have? What about the adaptability of your parents to move with your personality and change up their styles? What about the millions of things.
Mm-hmm. I did think it was interesting, just even from personal experience, in I think this the study that you and I both read, Mike, was if it's a struggle within the household of faith, like there's two different faiths happening, mm-hmm. you're constantly fight about it, that creates confusion, discord for the child, which that's how I grew up. And that's what I was terrified of when Michael and I started believing a little bit differently than each other. I was just like, well, this is all going to fall apart because it didn't work for my parents. Jenny, for you and Mike, he was straight up atheist. You were still a Christian. How did you handle that with your girls and how did you walk that?
Well, because he was hiding it for so long, we kind of continued to hide it the best we could, even from the girls, yeah. You know. I mean, like Madison was baptized. Mike walked her through, prayed with her through salvation while he was an atheist, and I didn't even know it. And so we kept going to church because Mike kept going to church. By the time it came out that he felt the way he had already had like his coming back to his belief, not the belief that it was, but believing in God again. However, that brought with it new things, you know, new issues like
BT Dubs, hell isn't real.
You know, our evangelical upbringing and being Southern Baptist, there were things that didn't bode well for the way, like in the church, the things he wrote about or the way he felt about things. And because we were such...
You can get married. Everybody gets married.
And because we were such active members, you know, people, and he was a deacon and a Sunday school teacher, people looked to him on that. So once that started falling apart, that's when it kind of then made its way into our household. Madison has always been, you know, just extremely intelligent. You know, I know we say that about all our children, you know, we feel that way about our children, but she's also so well read. You know, from an early age, she started reading and reading and reading. She's really good about coming to some conclusions on her own. And she's 12 now and in sixth grade, you know, she herself has really been developing what she believes in and what her faith is. And, you know, for Mike and I, part of that is we don't guide her into a specific path. We help guide her in her discovery. You know, what are the things she can consider? What are some things she can think about? But we're not there saying, this is what you believe, because we believe it. We try not to make it like so resolute, like that this is the line, you know, kind of thing. This is where you should be. For kids that go through, have parents that go through deconstruction, and then the kids themselves might go through it. And since we have one that's already in middle school, you know, one of the things now for Madison, especially with this past year and all the different issues that come about, it's not just religious issues anymore. It's like social justice issues. It's like political issues, because those are all things that are part of our household, at least, you know, those are things that we start talking about, especially when you start changing, your faith starts changing, and the specifics of like, okay, so we're not Southern Baptists anymore because in that denomination, they believe da 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 da, you know, and that's not what we believe anymore. So for her, what's happened as she's been transitioned into middle school is that her friendships, you know, she's having a hard time because as she becomes more vocal and convicted in her beliefs, she wants to tell people and she wants to share that. And she has a lot of pushback from her friends, her friend group. She's had to kind of navigate those waters of, you know, these are her friends. So she has to learn that also that they're going to have different beliefs than she does, and that's okay.
But her friends aren't always okay with that.
Yeah.
Even if she's okay with it.
In what different way does she believe in her friends? That's the thing I just...
Well, that, like, so she... Here's some big things in her middle school. They're real excited about a recent election.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
About the victory
In the affirmation.
Yeah.
A lot of her friends are conservative evangelicals, so they believe in a literal hell, and they believe that the changing marriage laws in this country are an abomination and an affront to God. And my little justice advocate daughter is not only disagrees, but she's not just going to be quiet that she doesn't agree. And so that creates social strife and some teasing and some bullying just because she believes differently.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is she's maintained some friendships all the way back from the time period when we went to a Baptist church in town. And so it's not like every kid in her school is in that place in terms of spiritual or political affiliation. It's just a lot of her friends are, and she doesn't want to just move on. And it's a tough thing to talk to a middle schooler about navigating. I didn't have any friends in middle school, but so I never had to worry about that problem. But to try to imagine, it's actually easier for me to talk to her about theological and existential and philosophical issues than the mechanics of, no, what do you actually do in middle school about this?
Mm-hmm. And our circumstance is different, of course, from some people in that, you know, her father speaks and he writes about, you know, these issues. And so it's a regular part of our life.
But I mean, kids are so different. I mean, that's right. That's got me at the beginning of the episode, because our Macy, our youngest daughter,
she's a hedonist.
She doesn't give a crap about any of this stuff. Well, she's kind of can be a hedonist, but she also like believes in a literal hell and fights with Madison about that.
She does believe in literal hell?
Oh, yeah. Hell's a place. People go there.
Oh, interesting. Wow. I wonder what... Lucy doesn't believe anything. Lucy's a...
Lucy's just with God all the time. She doesn't have to leave. Okay, Macy, how are you?
Good.
Good. So here's the thing. Even though I'm your dad and you're my daughter, right now we're just talking as friends, and everything you say is fine, and nothing you say can get you in trouble. Okay?
Okay.
So just anything you say, all I want to know is your thoughts, feelings, and opinions. Okay?
Okay.
Macy, who is God?
God is... he's like a spirit that watches over us and he cares for us and he makes us. I imagine him kind of like a blue light that shines on us and cares for us and wraps us in warmth when we're cold, and when we're hot, it cools us down.
And who is Jesus?
He's like God's son, but he's not a spirit. He's like a human.
How do you think parents should talk to their children about God?
I think parents talk to their children about God very calm. And if the child says something that they don't like, they shouldn't start yelling at them. They should be very calm, and they should say, hey, we don't say that, in a very calm voice.
If parents start to believe different things about God than they used to, should they tell their kids about that?
I think they should, but I also think that they should let their child believe what their child wants to believe, because you don't believe whatever your parents believe, because you need to be your own person. But it's good to tell them, so that way they can like know more about that.
What would you tell parents who are afraid to talk to their children about new ideas about God, or going to a different church, or not going to church at all?
I would tell them to be confident that their children still love them no matter what they say. And even if they get upset, they'll forgive you. And also, when you do talk to them, just be in a very relaxed voice and be very calm and don't get nervous. You should be excited to tell your children about God.
You're very wise, Macy.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. With this episode being the first one in 2017, we just wanted to first say Happy New Year. And a huge thank you to all the liturgists out there who have made this show and everything that we're doing possible. Those of you that have contributed to Patreon, especially. We are so grateful for you. And actually, with the contributions of the patrons over this last year, we've been able to start doing a whole bunch of cool new stuff. We have a team assembled that is working on more liturgies. We are working on some meditations and things like that that we're going to be able to offer. We're working on a new app that is going to be coming out later this year. And we're able to continue doing this podcast. So we just want to thank all of you who have been a part of that. If you'd like to join the patrons and get the bonus podcast that Mike and I do on the off weeks of this show called The Liturgist Conversations, you can go to theliturgists.com and just click on that donate button and become one of the liturgists that make all of this happen. We are so grateful for all of you, for your generosity and time, and we look forward to this new year with you. We think that this world needs these sort of conversations more than ever. There's a lot of work to do, so let's keep talking. Keep working, keep loving. So much love for all of you. All right, let's get back to the show.
Amelie had a confrontation with someone in our family. Someone in our family was here and was talking with a friend of mine about Jesus and how they needed to invite Jesus in their heart. And I was upstairs when this conversation was happening, and Amelie was downstairs with them. And I came down, and Amelie pulled me aside and told me about the conversation. And she said that she needed to speak with this certain family member right away and tell them that people that are born with God in their heart. So she sat them down. She goes, if we're born of God, how could we ever be outside of God?
Yeah.
Like, shooey! I like that. I like that. I said, well, honey, you're born, and then...
And then you for
boys, they masturbate.
Here's a brownie, Amelie. How's that cotton taste?
Let me really teach you. I know you think that you are pure and godly, but let me teach you what's at the core of your heart.
But I like that thought that she has. Like, we're born with God in our heart. You know, like, growing up evangelical in Southern Baptist, we go to VBS all the time. Every summer, there's VBS. And I worked VBS for many years, you know. And
Vacation Brainwashing School.
Vacation, yes. Bible School. So I even hesitate even talking about it because, you know, it did, you know, give me a lot of the Bible stories and a lot of foundation in Bible knowledge. I will say, though, that the way VBS is set up is, you know, to tell the kids, essentially, if you don't believe in God and if you don't make a confession of faith and on that Thursday and you're gone on Friday, then, you know, hell's what's going to be the end result, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what they look for. They want that Thursday for those kids to come forward with a confession of faith and to go with someone and have a prayer of salvation, and then they get baptized the following week or the week after, you know. And, you know, those kids, you know, when I think about the things that the way VBS was set up and the lessons and stuff, you know, it really, you know, Michael had mentioned it, shaming, you know, it really guilts and shames the kids into some kind of confession of Jesus Christ as their Savior and Lord. Mm-hmm. And I don't think kids really fully understand that or can even, you know, contemplate what that means when it's almost a coercion week, you know. Well, no, there was just one instance, like even in our new church, and we haven't really had any kind of situation where something was being taught that we really didn't, you know, like about what the kids were listening or anything. But there was, you know, I was helping with VBS and I was doing the story time. And on that Thursday in that VBS book that we got, you know, it was what they wanted you to do was take a cross, two beams of wood, and get some nails and have the kids nail, you know, a piece of paper that had their name on it because they were the reason Jesus died. Yeah. And the age that these kids were, they were
little kids.
They were little kids. I mean, because the way our VBS was small, so it was actually set up where you had kids mixed in with other ages, you know, so you didn't have one set age. So you had like some kids that were like maybe kindergarten, maybe even younger than kindergarten, like VPK to fifth grade. And so how are you going to tell a kid that's in VPK who's 4 years old, you know, why, you know, you're the reason Jesus died. It's because of you. So I remember, you know, I saw it. We talked to our Minister of Education and we came to a conclusion because even once we pointed it out to them, they were like, oh no, we can't do that. Yeah. So we did it in a different way. In fact, I invited Mike in that night to, you know, we talked more about the love that Jesus has for all his children, for all, you know, and it was more about our love for Jesus.
We cut out hearts and we had the kids write their names on the heart. And then I talked about how Jesus came and taught this message of love and grace and peace, and it upset the powerful so much that he was executed. And it was to show God's response to violence. And so I would have them come in and tape their heart to the cross and tell them that God loved them. Mm-hmm. But there was no, like, zero substitutionary atonement theory.
Yeah.
That whole coercion and shame thing, I think that's the most important thing if you're going to involve your children in spirituality, in religion, in a church. I think the most important thing is avoiding those elements at all costs. And kind of like you said, Lisa, like the discomfort with just handing your child over to someone, those teachings are so prevalent in the modern American church, you don't know what they're going, even if you found a church that's not so theologically abusive, you don't know what some person in a Sunday school class is going to say. Right.
Exactly.
And so you almost have to equip your kids. Like, how encouraging is it that Ami came to you and expressed a concern and communicated about it? To me, that's a sign that you're doing a good job teaching your children to navigate spirituality and religion as opposed to just being indoctrinated.
Yeah, and I think one thing that became, it's funny, Michael always had a harder time with authority than I did, as everyone knows. But I think it's been after, in the aftermath of all of this, that I'm right there with him and can clearly see what the authority did in my own life, even, of going, wait, why was I told there that, yes, you respect everyone, but this idea of like, well, this is the adult and they know and they have the authority to teach you this and what they say goes. In Sunday school, I mean, that's how it was for me. And so I just had to buy everything that they were dishing out, you know, because they were our elders. They're older. They had the authority of the man of God, right? So for us, we've had many conversations with Amelie, and we will have that with Lucy, of like, you need to question, you need to think deeply about what someone is telling you. And just because someone's older does not mean that they know. Because that every kid feels that way, even about, you know, about their parents. Like, you know everything. How do you know all these things? How can you lift things that I can't lift? There's this like God-esque thing about parents when your kids are real little, because we know things they don't know. And so they automatically think we know everything. And so that's easy for them to look to any adult and just look for the answers. And so for us, I feel like that's been very important for us to tell Amelie. Of, you don't trust everyone. Love people. Be kind to people. You don't need to trust people and just accept what they're telling you specifically in Sunday school. I think we were at the lake, Michael's parents' lake house one day, and there was an older boy. Some friends came with us, and there was an older boy, and then it was Amelie, and then he has a little sister, and he was like, "All right, I'm the leader today. You guys have to obey me." And his little sister goes, "Okay." And Ami goes, "No." She just walks off. They laugh so hard. They're like, "Well, she's your guy's daughter, that's for sure." She was like, "No, that's not what's going to happen. We're all going to take turns leading," or something like that. It was funny. But it was like, shocked their son, because he's so used to, you know, be like, "I'm the oldest and I'm the boy, so I'm going to boss everyone around."
So I think there's this thing about parenting in our society that is sort of like the higher part of the hierarchy of needs in deconstruction itself, where we get to this place in society where we feel parenting, like, think how much more we're all concerned about this than a lot of our parents were about us. We have all this extra, like, everybody's in car seats and everybody's got the right diets now for their kids. You got to have... How can I be the perfect parent? And we stress out about it, and all the parenting magazines and parenting blogs and parenting everything.
Our parents
podcasts.
Didn't even have car seats, like, not even the right
I
car
sat in
seats.
The front in between my parents and the console, which is not safe, but but there's a stress about it. And I think there's something fine and good about wanting to be the best parents we can be. But I also think that, just like, part of why I think the studies are always going to fall short with child rearing, at least until we figure out some other way of getting all the data, like plugging in the actual DNA of the child into the study, or, you know, like I think that talking about a human being, it's too complex to think about issues as determining factors and what percentage of determining factors. I don't think there's any way we can know such a thing. I mean, if Gandhi was born as a Pentecostal to a really overbearing mother, would he have been Gandhi? How do we know? I don't mean would he have been Gandhi and the things he actually did, but like would he still have been a peaceful person? Would he still have been changing the world, but from Christianity rather than from, you know what I mean? Would Francis, if he had been born as a Hindu, would he have been a different St. Francis? Would Hitler have been what he was without, it's too complex. So we get all stressed out about all these things. What religious doctrines should I teach? What kind of diet should they have? What kind of school should they go to? Should they live in an urban environment? Should they live in a country, rural environment? What's the perfect thing to make the perfect child? And I think thinking about those questions too much ends with anxiety. You know, as parents, we do have an incredible mark on our children. We do have this tremendous responsibility, and what we do is going to make them largely who they are, but we don't know what's going to do what. Like, think about your own parents. I'm imagining the things that my parents thought were the most important things for me and the things that would really change me and shape me are probably things that I don't even remember, but there are things that I saw that they probably didn't realize that I saw that actually did make a difference in what my assumptions about marriage were, what my assumptions about business or how to be a friend, or, you know, like all the little things. It's often the unseen things and the unsaid things that make a huge difference. So, like, I think the thing that you can be is the most spacious, loving, and present person that you can be as a parent. And all the details as far as doctrines and do I take my kid to church? We're going to make bad decisions, good decisions. I think that all we have really to offer as our kids is who we are, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. All these little things come out of who we are. We're going to say, yeah, I think we should teach these sorts of doctrines and avoid these kind of churches and whatever. That's the specifics coming out of who we are. The most important thing we can be is healthy and true to who we are as human beings, and offer that space for a new human being and a new soul to grow within and thrive within.
Like, on the one hand, I completely agree with you. Like, completely. Like, I think we just worry too much about it. Like, mainly don't drop your kids on their head. Don't throw them in traffic. Don't actively cause physical harm to them. And we just obsess about things too much. And that we kind of overplay the role we have in their lives as parents. So, on the one hand, I completely agree with everything you said, Michael. You're literally describing my parenting philosophy. And on the other hand, I've been in my house and I've been in yours. And I'd be really interested to see to what degree Lisa and Jenny agree with that sentiment as arguably more active parents in the respective homes than you and I. And I'm 100% serious. Yeah. Because, like, when it's just me and the girls, or just Michael and the girls, like, it gets pretty wild, pretty wild. Fast.
Everything,
like,
gets
I don't
destroyed.
Really know where the kids are or what they're doing. Yeah. Or
yes. Yes. No. I feel like, especially over this last year, for me, something that's been incredibly important is two things. And I was thinking a lot about these two things before we were talking about this one. Being present with my girls, because from what I've learned is I've friends from all kinds of religions, and what they speak most about is if their parent was present with them or not. Not specifically what they taught them about their religion, because a lot of them have left whatever religion they've come from, but was their parent present with them and were they listening to them instead of just only teaching them all the time? Was a parent present enough to see the child and what the child and listen and what the child wanted to say? The other thing was kindness. you know, Michael, when we met, he would laugh a lot and say, you know, I'm surprised that you're not a completely unstable person. And just from some of the things that I'd gone through. And I was thinking about that this morning. And I think one thing that really grounded me was seeing kindness in my mom and in my dad, but more specifically my mom, because she did this thing. She wouldn't call it a practice. She didn't tell people about it, but her and I would walk every week and visit elderly people in our neighborhood, and we would take them food or we would clean their home, and we would go over and just see what they needed. And I really saw my mom's faith wasn't just this idea that she had or this thing that she was shoving down my throat, but she really believed it, that kindness did something in people's lives. I want to show that to our daughter. And I, even in some of those studies we were talking about, Mike, that's one thing that impressed upon me as well, is don't talk to your children about just happiness. Talk to them about kindness. So for me, being present in kindness has been incredibly important, as well as also letting go of my expectations of having the perfect car seat and all that jazz.
I wasn't quite saying, like, just don't worry, meaning sit back and don't worry about getting the best car seat, or don't, you know. What I'm more saying is, if you're the kind of person that is really passionate about getting the best car seat, go with it. You're going to go with it anyway. It doesn't matter. Like, what's going to happen is what's going to happen. I'm just kind of like, the doctrines that really matter to you, you're going to teach. The values that you really have, they're going to happen. Relax in that. Not saying don't worry, don't do it. Don't be yourself. Don't do the things that you find. But if you're really a person that believes a clean environment for your kids is the most important thing, do it. Have a clean environment. I mean, maybe take the edge off of it with the anxiety if you can. It's easy to spin your mind into all the things that you aren't thinking about. Mm-hmm. All the things that you're, should we be vegetarians? Is that the best? You know, like, if you're not a vegetarian, don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah.
You're not a vegetarian. You know, if you are, be a vegetarian. So, Jenny, what was your take on any of that?
Wait, what?
Are you a don't worry about it parent? Do you think that's a...
Again, I get, what do y'all think? Do you think I'm a don't worry
about it? Yeah, I also want to say, yes, exactly. I'll let you go.
If anything, can think of even the things that you don't really need to worry about, I'll go ahead and worry about for you. You know, that's the kind of thing I'll do.
I've had more anxiety being a parent than ever before in my life. I'm going, oh my gosh. And like, Amelie, the whole thing of going into a school in LA and choosing a school, gosh, like, I really wish she could just go to our neighborhood school, but we visited it and it's like, it's awful. And so I have all this anxiety of the school I pick for my child right now is going to determine the rest of her life. Or yeah, if I feed her meat and there's carcinogens or different things in it she shouldn't be taking, that's my fault. And if she gets a disease, or Lucy, oh my gosh, I mean, all the things I worry about with Lucy, I've drank more alcohol the past 5 years. It was sending me meditate. Like, I have to meditate. I have to. It's not like a should I. I have to meditate and pray, or I like become this ball of anxiety. And it's all stems from parenting, because it's nerve-wracking to wonder if you're going to totally wreck your kids' lives. And I'm probably going to somewhere.
This woman had a shirt at an event,
yeah.
And it said, Mommy needs her bottle. Her wine bottle.
That's a good shirt. But in the end, it's all meaningless and none of us exist anyway, so.
Wait, that sounds like the end of a podcast. We're not quite there.
You just rushed it, right?
Don't rush it.
Whoa.
Don't worry about your kids. They don't exist. And neither do you.
You know, this just came to mind. One thing that I've noticed has changed for us is we're a lot more open, I think, with even how we talk specifically to like sexual things with Amelie.
Yeah.
And I mean, because when I was young, you don't talk about sex. Like my sex talk from my dad was like, don't have sex because you're going to, that'd be so embarrassing to the family if you got pregnant. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And that was it. That was all. And so with Amelie, like we'll have these talks, like she's very open with us, you know? And so like, I don't go, oh my gosh, I can't believe you thought that. Or, oh my gosh, baby girl, don't do this, don't do that. And, you know, I was talking to another friend of mine and they caught their child trying to nurse their other child. And they're really young. And she realized like her first response was like, oh my gosh, stop doing that. Like that's perverted. And but the more we talked about, I'm like, oh, but that's not perverted. Like they're children. They see other mothers nursing. This is a totally natural part. Like that all lends to the shame thing, right? Of being ashamed of our bodies. And I find the more like we just don't live in that anymore. And so I'm so much more open to talking with Amelie. So in turn, she's telling me everything. You know, she sees something, tells me how it makes her feel. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. And even, I mean, we've had the talk. We're probably going to tell her pretty soon about sex. And I don't want it to be like this massive turn of events. Like all of a sudden we had the huge sex talk, you know. It's like, well, yeah, this is what happens. And as she has different questions, we've been honest with her. And I feel like it's on this course of this very natural, gradual course of she's probably going to be a little embarrassed. But I don't want it to be this massive thing that we don't, that it's one talk and then we never talk about it.
But again, we don't know what these effects are going to be. Okay, so like as an example, I heard this podcast about this town that they found these really detailed records about, I think it was in Europe, and they kept these really crazy detailed records about all the people in the town. And so they were able to figure out all these sociological phenomena about, you know, diet and lifestyle and how people died and what age. They were able to get all this valuable research out of these documents. And one of the things they found was that the generations that had had shortage of food, that they had had famines and had gone times of near starvation or real hard times, they actually, that really benefited them in the long run with a bunch of different kinds of diseases and being strong. And not only benefited them, but their kids or their grandkids or something.
Yeah, epigenomics.
Yeah. So like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How do you have no idea what you're doing to this kid or to their kids or to their kids' kids. I mean, we have hopes and thoughts about this is what I think this is going to do, but nobody's going to say like starve your kids when they're young so that
they're stronger.
So they're stronger and their grandkids are stronger. You don't.
That's true.
We don't know what the repression that we had now allowed us to come into free, you know, I don't want to repress our kids.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, what are you going to do? You can't control any of it really. So you got to be true to your heart and your beliefs and your convictions.
Absolutely.
And kind of rest in that, I suppose.
But I feel like that's different of like, here's what we're doing to teach our children. That's one thing. And it's a different thing to say, I'm going to protect them against everything. That's not what it is. Cause yeah, that's absolutely true. The more you try to put your kid in a bubble, the less they know how to deal with the world.
So with the basic assumption that more conversations and more openness about sexuality seem to have better data indicators about teen pregnancy, promiscuity, STD acquisition, and other variables, I've tried to foster an open environment about sexual discussion in our home. And I mean, you know, I'm not especially prone to feeling taboo about sex discussions to begin with. So it doesn't make me uncomfortable at all to talk about sex with my kids.
Hello, I'm Mike. Oh,
I kind of need to pause after that sentence. I enjoyed that very much.
And so when we talked to Madison about sex, I was like, just really, she was wanting to know kind of what that was. So I was like, yeah, come in here. And I kind of described it. We looked in a book. We talked about a lot of stuff. And I was like, anytime you want to know anything, I'm here. She was obviously significantly more uncomfortable than I was, but really pretty. It was a very constructive time. But when Macy wanted to have the talk. It was a completely Macy thing.
She had three questions.
She brought a folder. She's going to do a presentation and set the folder down, set the notebook out, got a pen, wrote the number one, wrote out her question, and was ready for us to write down our answer.
Yes.
The first question was, what is sex?
Or how do people make a baby?
How do people make a baby? Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
How do people make a baby?
And so I was like, okay. So like I kind of went into sex and sexuality and reproductive organs. Jenny drew this amazing reproductive system map
that looked nothing like
the actual reproductive system.
It looked nothing like it.
So okay. I had to come in and kind of then draw an actual female reproductive system. But then like Macy was getting like increasingly mortified by the mechanics of how this happens. And so you could tell she was just not really into it. She's like, okay, that's enough. So then her second question
was, what does it mean when you say sucking too hard on a lollipop?
In that song.
No. In that song. It was, she had heard the song from the, like, it's one of the Pitch Perfect movies. Anyway.
Which I remember, I'm not real into Shane, but I walked in and Macy's watching that with Jenny and she's singing. I'm like, Jenny, what do you have her watching? Because Macy will repeat anything she sees on TV. And so I was like, well, if you don't like the answer number one, you're really not gonna like the answer to number two. And she goes, okay, never mind. And then she went to question three, which was,
can I have a new bed set?
What?
She wanted a new bed set, like comforter and pillowcase. So her three questions were, where does a baby come from? What does it mean sucking too hard on a lollipop? And can I have a new bed set?
Oh, that's really funny.
My dad just told me about our sex talks. We were all over the Christmas holidays.
David's he was saying, so good.
He was saying that, like, I was very quick and factual and like, okay, I was the kind of kid, like, I will look up in the Encyclopedia Britannica anything I need to know after this conversation. I'm fine. Let's just call it quits. David
was so excited
and like, Dad, you do that with Mom?
How many times?
When's the last time you did
it? What does it feel like?
What does it feel like, Dad? Tell me what does it feel like.
I get to do that? Like, he's just so excited.
I bet David's real excited you just said that. He's going to be real happy about that. For that matter, your parents will probably be thrilled as well.
Yeah. We've always tried to be really conscious about avoiding shame, avoiding repression that's going to turn into some kind of darkness, especially when you're talking about body stuff, sex stuff. But there's going to be, because we don't try to like make, we tell you can't show your genitals to people, but it's not because they're bad or they're ugly or they're anything. Just, you know, it's not what you do in society. So, but then it's funny and she's laughing about how boys have wieners. And then the other day she
Which
says,
is hilarious.
It is hilarious.
Yeah. She said that she didn't want to have a little boy, and she died laughing. I said, why? She says, because the wieners.
But then in talking about it, she'll ask, like, oh, look this up on your phone. Or she asked me, like, the other day,
oh,
look this up on your phone.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, okay. I'm not thinking, like, I don't want to pull up some, like, guy's D on a Google for my daughter.
But yeah, we both looked at each other going, oh, well.
Parenting decision.
But again, that's really cool that she can say that. She feels comfortable saying
yeah,
that
it's
to
not
you.
Like a bad
hey,
thing
can you look up?
Yeah.
So Madison I can see would what never.
Madison wouldn't know. Macy might, but even then, Macy's becoming the age where she's like, she would probably be like, she'd either start laughing or she would, she might be a little, she'd give a look like, no.
But if the curiosity's there, like it's not like they're going to not look it up themselves eventually when they can't. So
then,
do you want to throw it? That was my, like, what do you,
and what
do
are
we keep this
her?
In the light? Do we, I didn't want to, but I also don't want to be the dad that's going to pull up That's going to show my daughter some like porn or something. You know what I mean?
But yeah, even so her going like, wait, what's wrong about looking that up? Like in that moment that there was two distinct things of like, are we showing our daughter porn right now? Or are you
And I didn't
teaching? Pull no, off that. Yeah, of course you didn't. Or like she in this moment, she knows we think there's something wrong with this.
But I did pull up a picture that I thought was funny that was like a joke picture that had the caption. It was like a hot dog thing or something. She's like,
I can just imagine it. It makes me laugh.
But those are the, it's tricky. It's always tricky. Parenting.
In this instance, I do think that there's some good books out there. And so like for somebody like our Madison, you know, she does really well when she has something to read. You know, if she has something to read and to read through it and then have questions for us, more specific things, that actually helps her. She processes it a little bit better, I think, in some ways.
So I think that uncovers an important point. Like on the other side of deconstruction, it's not actually anything goes in parenting. It's not like your child says, hey, could you show me some hardcore pornography? Yeah. And you just pull up, you know, a tube site and go to town. It's that you reflect on your own reaction to questions. And it's still okay to tell a child something's not appropriate and why. Mm-hmm. It's okay to redirect, to show a cartoon wiener instead of a penis. That's a valid strategy, but there's a lightness to it. A couple of months ago, I was on tour. I was home briefly, and Madison, I don't know where she gets it. She's super philosophical. She reads a lot. She asks really tough questions. And so she comes in and she's like grilling me about the nature and character of God and prayer and incarnation and salvation and eternal life, everything, which she does pretty regularly.
Well, it was also in conjunction with those confirmation classes.
Right, because she's going through confirmation. She's like, Dad, I can't be confirmed. I don't really know if I believe most of this stuff. So I can't like confirm that. And so she's asking me all these questions, and I realize she's going like chapter by chapter of a book I wrote. So I reach into my giant box of books that the publisher sent me, and I pulled out a copy of the book, which she's been like begging me for since it came out. But I told her that it was like a little too grown up for her, which was really dumb. It's not. But I didn't want to I didn't want my book to start her like on premature deconstruction, right? But here she is. She's like very clearly demonstrating that she's ready for this. I pull the book out of the box and I just open to, whenever I sign the book, I always sign the title page. But this time I turn to the dedication page because in the dedication of the book, it says for Madison and Macy, who already have questions on their own journeys with God. And I was like, well, this is it. This is happening. So then I wrote to Madison, my love, may your thirst for truth lead you to love, light, and peace. May God kiss your cheeks and tell you you are beloved. Love, Dad. And then I gave her the book. Like, I gave her a book of questions. I didn't give her a bunch of answers, but ways to look for answers and ways to be comfortable when we can't find answers. I didn't have any expectation that that would fix something or that anything was wrong. But I thought it could help her make an informed decision about whether she wanted to go through confirmation or not. And as she worked through the book and especially started to read about the church, she actually got confirmed while I was out of town. So it was a little bit of a suspense thing for me. And I asked her, I said, Madison, did you decide to get confirmed? She said, yeah. I said, well, what did you decide? Did you decide you believe all those things? And she said, no. I said, okay, then how'd you decide to be confirmed? And she said, I realized that being confirmed is not about a bunch of ideas, but instead about saying that I'm devoted to the church and the church is devoted to me. And it was all about, I did guide her, but I also gave her her space. And so I hope she's never in therapy one day telling about how her parents coerced her into confirmation, but instead that she found her own way.
Okay, maybe we could start wrapping this up by talking about just a couple of things that each of us have done that seem to work.
I didn't know it was that formal an interview.
Go for it. Meditation has been a very practical thing for us in Amelie. And like Amelie is the one who told me that she needed it because like if she's having bad dreams. Because for a little while we stopped, like we would pray with her, you know, when we were going to Bloom and we're pastoring the church there. And then we kind of stopped for a little while because I wasn't exactly sure how to pray. And then we started praying again and doing a blend of like prayer and meditation. And that seems to help her tremendously. Because there's a difference between just going, God, I pray that these bad dreams go away. Or we pray, you know, I'm not going to pray like that this happens. And this was actually Amelie's idea. She said, you know, when I close my eyes and I calm myself and I center myself and I let the fear go, then I'm just more relaxed and that's how I have good dreams instead of just praying for it and thinking it's kind of out of her power that someone, some high being is like going to grant her good dreams or bad dreams, you know? And in the morning, if she wakes up with bad dreams, she wonders why God grant her bad dreams. I mean, that's kind of a rough situation. So meditation at nighttime, and then also when she's dealing with tough situations with kids at school or even at home, and she starts getting anxious and frustrated with something she can't do or frustrated with a kid that's being a little mean to her, she meditates.
Yeah, practice is a good... I mean, when I think back to my childhood and what like the practices have changed for me, and I know, Lisa, you had something like my dad, just like your mom, would like set the timer and say, you're going to be praying in tongues for the next 15 minutes.
Oh, 15 minutes. I had to do like an hour, sometimes 2 hours, yeah.
2 hours?
Oh my gosh, we are like dedicated.
But what I was getting at was the practice that I learned in my Pentecostal, charismatic, evangelical world of prayer, fasting, worship, all the things that have changed in their specificity for me. I am glad that I learned how to practice something. I am glad that I learned how to focus, turn my heart towards something. So some sort of religious practice or spiritual practice I really am grateful for in my own life. And we do try to pass that on to Amelie.
One thing that we've been trying to do more of is having like less distractions in the house. Mm-hmm. Like less TV time, less, you know, they have iPads, that kind of thing. And so we're really trying to make a concentrated effort on limiting that and really focusing more like on family time or conversing together, or we're all reading together, but we're reading our own thing, but reading together, you know, we're all in the practice of reading something, whatever it might be. And then when Mike is in town, we do make an effort to try to go to church. We're there sitting together as a family and having our time afterwards, you know, going to lunch and that kind of thing with others. We have a group of people that we regularly have over to the house, or we meet with them, and our girls are really social. So we try to they love it when they get to interact, and we try to make them be a part of what we're doing. So that's another thing. Like there's not a lot of instances that we have anymore where, no, you can't hear this or you can't be a part of it. Go, you know, there are some times where there's like adult discussions going on, but for the most part, they are active contributors too in those conversations.
One thing that I've, from the beginning, but more so since we've kind of seen her personality develop, we really feel like we have an Enneagram 2 in the making, the way she is. And who knows, that might change, but I'm already trying to like use brainwashing techniques to try to minimize some of the pain that comes to two in the form of feeling that they need to do something to deserve love or to earn it. So I very regularly just like look her in the eyes and be like, Amelie, you are made of love, and there's nothing you can do to be loved more or less. You can't do anything about it. It's everything in you and around you, and you will always be loved. So I just like try to brainwash her with that. I don't have any idea if it'll be effective. It's something I'm trying, though.
What do you have?
I just have 8 brief bullet points about a systematic guide to parenting.
I thought I would go last
because my thoughts are exceptionally organized.
All right, let's hear the 8 bullet points, Mike.
Okay, they're real simple. 1, a loose grip posture. I always realize that I can't actually control my kids at all. I can influence them, but I can't control them. Their actions and beliefs are their own. 2, I always affirm my love for them, both with affection and words. And I do that often with intention. 3, I encourage questions and open conversation, and I eliminate all taboo. 4, I validate struggle. I don't tell my kids things should be easy. I don't tell them they should always be happy. When they have trouble on homework or have trouble with friends, I tell them you don't know how to do this yet, but you can learn. Or I tell them when they get a good grade, I don't tell them how smart they are. I tell them how hard they worked. And I try to validate the fact that it's mainly through struggle that things are accomplished. 5, I'm honest about what I believe, along with the limitations on what I know. So I'm perfectly fine sharing my opinion on something, but I'm also open to discussion and preemptively disclose that my understanding has limits. 6, I set healthy boundaries. A lot of people respond to the kind of overbearing parenting style of the past with a completely hands-off style for children, and an utter lack of limitations on behavior or social convention are also unhealthy for children. So they do need some form of boundary. My thing is those boundaries are up for discussion and debate as the children grow and develop. And part of that is point number 7, meet them where they are and know what they value. I do not parent both of my kids the same way. They have unique perspectives and unique needs. Macy has to eat 3 square meals a day in order to be happy. So I understand, like, if she has a temper tantrum and we had a late breakfast and no lunch, part of that is I've failed to understand how she relates to the world and what's developmentally appropriate. I also understand that for me to respond to a question from Macy with 20 minutes of science isn't going to be received well, whereas Madison would really, really, really appreciate that. And then the last point, and I think is a really necessary point today, is don't overschedule. Don't plan too much in my life, the family life, or enroll my kids in a ton of extracurricular activities, because they need the time and the space just to be children, especially in an age where physical education and recess have been cut from public curriculum and there's more homework than ever. We understand developmentally the thing that helps children be healthiest, happiest, and most successful is unstructured playtime. And so I make sure that we have lots and lots of open time in all of our schedules to accommodate that.
Well, let's hope that our kids don't grow up to be monsters.
Or senators.
If they are, they can blame the liturgists.
Thanks again to all the patrons. Special thanks to the team that put together this episode. Thanks to Greg Nordine, as always, for his editing help. Corey Pig and Madison Chandler with administration. And Tyler Chester for helping me with some of the music. Thanks for listening, everybody.